This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Today we're talking about, believe it or not, football. The life and football legacy of the great Illinois coach for 29 years, Bob Zupke, with the author of a recent book on Zupke, Maynard Britchford, for 34 years himself, the university archivist here at the University of Illinois. And Maynard, you've written about many interesting things over your long career, but is this your first time writing about a football coach?
Yes, it is.
And how did you happen to choose this topic?
Well, as a university archivist, we had a collection of Zupke papers, and I discussed them with some of the people using the archives. We thought he would be a very interesting character. However, 30 years passed before I was able to have time to work on a book, and I started this in the past 7 years. Gradually, the book took shape.
Now, Zupke retired in, what was it, 1941?
1941 was his last
year. Yeah, and so he had started as football coach for Illinois.
1912, he was signed. First year was 1913.
And before, he'd been a high school coach, and I thought this would be interesting for Keeping the Faith because of so many issues that are still in the news about sports ethics, sports values, and even what some claim to be the spirituality of sports, of how they contribute to a person or to a society, a person's character or society. Yes. Quite controversial issues.
Character building is indeed a thing that the academics disparage that. Yet Zupke, it was not a really point of emphasis, but he thought it would build character, and I think that he had a good idea there.
Now, controversy came to Coach Zupke's life fairly often during those 3 decades. He was the football coach here at Illinois, although he was highly respected and considered by some to be the model, really, of running a clean program. We'll get in some details about that later and get your opinion. But at one point in his career, there was significant academic criticism here at the university and, in fact, nationwide, not so much of his program, but of how important football had gotten and how, as one person described it, it's become a religion. And so important to universities. The NCAA got involved, the American Association of University Professors. You talk about it in your chapter on academic criticism of Zupke and the football program. What did you think of those arguments?
Well, the arguments were the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching issued a report on college football and athletics in 1929. This had been gradually gathering steam during the 20s, particularly with the stadium building and the popularity of collegiate football. This was resented by people in academic positions. And I don't know, they fondly predicted that football would be a passing fad, but it was not the case. It has continued to be a favorite activity.
Grown even larger, and there were criticisms that had become, there were too high salaries for coaches, and at the time I think Zupke was getting half the salary of, say, the president of the university.
Yes, he was getting $10,000 in 1930, which, if you equate $1930 dollars with the present, is about $1 million, which is about what we're paying our coaches today.
Today. But at the time, the president was getting more, and I remember one of our former chancellors, when he went to University of Caltech in California, he said, well, at least he'd be making more there than the football coach.
Yeah.
Whereas at Illinois, he was making less at that time.
Yeah, the football coach usually did quite well compared to the deans.
The coach was making, even in Zupke's day, he was making more than the deans, you say, in one
most,
of your...
Most of them, yeah. Uh-huh.
High salaries was one of the criticisms, but also commercialization and professionalism for the student athletes. Did you think those criticisms at the time were justified during the 20s and 30s?
Well, professionalism arose right after World War I. And again, it prospered in the 1920s. Red Grange is a symbol of professional football. George Halas was one of the founders, and he was also a Zupke student.
One of the founders of the NFL, mm-hmm. National Football League, right?
So I don't think that commercialization affects, I think that results from perhaps the technologies change. Radio and eventually television changed, had an appreciable effect on football and sports.
Now, Red Grange, after playing at Illinois so successfully, finished his eligibility here, his years of eligibility, you point out in your new book on Bob Zupke. But then he left the university before he finished his degree here. He still had a year and a half or so to go, really, to finish all his credits, and went to play professional football for the Chicago Bears. And he was roundly criticized for that. And Zupke at first was very upset with him, but he later they sort of mended fences and became mutually supportive.
Zupke used to say that you couldn't tell when amateurism became professionalism.
Very hard line to draw.
Very hard line to draw. And the athletic director here was George Huff. And Huff wanted to have his baseball players play professional baseball in the summer. But they had problems with that.
Sure. And why don't you tell listeners about the Taylorville scandal? Because that gives a flavor of the period.
Well, that was came out of gambling, but it's also related to the development of football. In the early 1920s, a good many small towns had football teams.
Semi-pro, we would call them today, probably.
Semi-pro, and Zupke called them the Wild Bills from over the hills. And the rivalry between Carlinville, Illinois, and Taylorville, Illinois, rose in the early 1920s, and Carlinville, one of the players, decided to bring some of his friends from Notre Dame over to play against Taylorville. So much money was being wagered at the time that the word got to a Illinois player who recruited some other Illinois players, and they went down and played for Taylorville. So it was essentially Notre Dame versus Illinois.
And there was a lot of betting going on.
About $100,000, if they say, changed hands at that time as Carlinville lost to Taylorville. Illinois beat Notre Dame, which doesn't occur too often.
And when that sort of thing became more known, that resulted in some changes, didn't it?
Yes. It tied in with the rising academic criticism. The Carnegie people, AAUP, university presidents, and other people wrote in and tried to reform matters. Both universities, Notre Dame and Illinois, told these players that their eligibility was ended. They violated a rule. two or three of the Illinois players departed for the Chicago Bears.
Uh-huh. Now let's let me invite listeners to join this conversation. This is a live call-in show every week on WILL. And on Keeping the Faith, we're delighted to have people join in on our conversation. So do give us a ring. If it's a long-distance call, perhaps you're listening even online, 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free call. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area and it's a local call, do use our local lines, 9455. Your call will be answered by our good engineer, Kyle Kroa, and she will get you on the air as soon as we can. And with our guest, Maynard Bridgeford. Maynard's last name is spelled B-R-I-C-H-F-O-R-D, and he's the author of Bob Zupke, Z-U-P-P-K-E, The Life and Football Legacy of the Illinois Coach. Zupke was the longest tenured coach here at Illinois, and in fact, the longest tenured coach during his period at any of the state universities in the Big Ten, I learned from this book. But we're happy to have people call in, so do give us a ring, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Maynard, one of the surprising things to me in reading your book about Zupke was the difficulty he had as coming from a German background during this period, because, of course, Germany was the enemy of the U.S. during World War I and then the buildup of World War II. And he spoke with a heavy German accent, apparently. It went away a bit over time, you report. But tell us about that kind of a
relationship.
Yeah.
Well, he World War I, he was retained as the president of the Champaign County Boy Scouts, which was a movement which started about 1912 and grew rapidly across the country. It was tied in with the wartime fervor. And as a head of the Boy Scouts, he was sort of protected, I believe, by his association. The World War II, he was interviewed early on, about early 1940s, about what he thought about what was a program on Americanism or something of the sort. And at that time, Zupke said that the state was existed for the people and not the people for the state.
Is what he thought was happening in
what was going on.
And it's Germany, yeah.
Nazi Germany, it was basically on that level. And he was, his father, though, came to America in 1881. And he said that wherever your career is, that's your motherland. And fatherland, and it was not, he didn't carry over German loyalties.
Yes.
Milwaukee.
Or politics, yeah.
Yeah.
And Zupke had an interesting relation to politics and religion. He tended to sort of stay away from them, didn't he?
Well, I call it eclectic views of religion. He was a Lutheran by parentage, and he attended schools in a city that was 65% Roman Catholic. That's Milwaukee. He attended Mass at Notre Dame with Notre Dame coaches in New York. He was married to an Episcopalian by a Methodist minister and had a second marriage with a Presbyterian, a Presbyterian funeral, and bequeath money to Episcopalians, Presbyterians, and Methodists.
How interesting.
So he had involvement with a good many of them, but he never joined a church.
Uh-huh.
His wife was a very active
Episcopalian at Emmanuel Episcopal Church, yeah. You mentioned. And he had an interesting reaction when one of his former athletes that he was trying to help find a coaching position in Ohio was turned down by the president of the school board because he was Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
And Zupke was deeply offended by that sort of exclusion.
Yeah. Yeah, he did not believe in religious bias.
And he also was surprisingly open racially to African American athletes. Tell a little bit about that history. That was new to me, how early there were African American players on the football team at Illinois. I had thought that hadn't happened until after World War II, but you talk about it before World War I.
Well, there were players before World War I, but that stopped about 1910, 1905 in there. From then to 1938, there were no African-American players on the Illinois football teams. And it seems to me that one of the factors was the fact that Illinois had race riots in St. Louis, Springfield, Chicago, in the early years of Zupke's tenure here. And I think there was a lot of racial prejudice, and the Champaign-Urbana was not a very fertile area for changing these prejudices. So Zupke experienced, though, that Iowa and Northwestern sort of took the lead. And after playing against some of these schools, in the 1930s, the situation was changing. It was not a great thing that depended upon Jackie Robinson or some one individual. But gradually, Big Ten teams started using African-American players. Zupke started in 1938 with Alphonse Anders from the Quad Cities. And Ike Owens, who later played on a Rose Bowl team for Illinois, was also a played for Zupke's team before the Zupke resignation took effect.
You mentioned in your book in that chapter on dealing with integration, racial integration, that the number of African-American students at the whole university was only 50 in 1913 and only 100 in 1928. And by 1939, it had only grown to 132, and most of them were seeking teaching or professional degrees and had little time for sports, and a few athletic careers were open to them at that point. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the first organized housing was provided by black fraternities in 1917, and that starting in 1923, the University YMCA sponsored an interracial commission to try to improve things for the African-American students on campus, but there was not much positive response for many years. I know when I was director at the University Y, we were proud of the Y's history working for racial integration early on, but I was not aware that it had started that early. So that was...
Some faculty members, there's usually about a dozen or two faculty members will stand up and be counted at that time, were supporting this, but it was not a... There was no ban. As a state university, we would take anyone, but the bar was a bit high, and there were limited opportunities.
Let's talk about that academic climate, because many people today don't realize that the University of Illinois and other state universities in the Big Ten had an open admission policy to anyone who had graduated from Illinois High School. You could come and enroll at the University of Illinois. You just had to show up. You had to be a high school grad from the state, and you were automatically in the freshman class. But that first year, tell us about what it was like.
Well, I don't know. I was not a student at Illinois, but actually the numbers were a large percentage of the freshmen did not come back for the second year.
Yeah.
Other friends, they would come and maybe take a semester or so, then drop out of school. This changed substantially from, say, about 1920 to 1940. Gradually, they would come and complete their education. This has an interesting relationship to football in that freshmen were not eligible to play. So to play football for Illinois, you had to pass your courses in your freshman year. This got the first African-American player. There was always a problem of football players not having time to study.
Sure.
Time to attend classes.
And many of them had part-time jobs because there were no scholarships in those days.
Part-time work jobs.
Sure.
When they would go for an out-of-town game, the faculty would be very unhappy.
Yeah.
Because they might miss a class.
And they took attendance in those days.
Yes. Yeah. So it's...
It was difficult. You report that one of the statistics that I was amazed by was that in 1920, 49% of the students who started out their freshman year at Illinois dropped out.
Yeah.
Were not able to continue. Now, it had improved by 1935 to 24%, but that's still one in four is not making it after that first year of rhetoric or first year of chemistry or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing statistics. So you could get in, but it was hard to stay, and that was true for football players.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They had to get passing grades.
I was also surprised at what courses, what the majors were of football players during the Zupke era or eras. You point out in one place that 43% of the players were in engineering, 38% in agriculture, 11% in the College of Commerce.
That was very early.
Very early.
Very early. It started out that way.
Sure.
And this was true in the teens. When the 1920s came along, they founded the College of Education, and most of the students in the College of Education were football players. President Kinley did not believe that education was something that could be taught in the university. And
he thought people should go to normal schools.
Normal schools was the, we had Eastern, Western, Northern, and Southern normals. But the situation gradually changed, and they had a coaching program. We were teaching students, male students, usually, to be high school coaches. And that was a very popular curriculum in the 1920s.
Now, those football players who were majoring in education might take courses in coaching football, but they also had to take courses in English and rhetoric and literature, and there were requirements that were fairly stiff in those
mm-hmm.
days. So it wasn't that they were getting a totally easy ride, but at least in their major, they would perhaps have sympathetic professors.
Yeah, they were... I think they were made aware of these requirements. And they also they had to have jobs. Alumni, assistant coaches would try and line up jobs.
Because there were not scholarships.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Well, there were no scholarships.
Right.
Zupke was not directly involved. He referred this to other people.
Uh-huh.
And this was the...
But typically the students, as you report, would have to do work for these jobs. They weren't sinecures.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. You know, maintenance work, food, and firing the furnace, things of uh-huh. that sort.
Uh-huh. We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Maynard Brichford, B-R-I-C-H-F-O-R-D, the archivist for the University Archivist Emeritus for the University of Illinois, about his recent book, just out this year, 2009, on Bob Zupke, Zuppke, for 29 years, the football coach at the University of Illinois. The book is subtitled The Life and Football Legacy of the Illinois Coach. It's available from McFarland & Company, local bookstores and Amazon and so forth, places to look for it, other places online. found it very interesting to read about this period. Zupke came to this university when it was very small and stayed till when it was quite a large university, and so that period was interesting in itself. I want to talk about his attitude toward recruitment, but let me give the phone numbers again if listeners would like to ask questions. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If people are listening, or it's a long-distance call, including if you're listening online, 1-800-222-9455. And if you've missed part of this program, like all of our programs, it will be archived at WILL online at will.illinois.edu. You can then click on AM when you have a choice between AM, FM, and TV. And then you can go to Keeping the Faith, and you'll see our whole list of past programs. So you can listen to any one of to the rest of this if you missed it, or to other programs. So again, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We're talking about sports and ethics and even spirituality. Let's talk a little bit about that. Tell us some of the things Zupke said. He was quite a well-known public speaker. He traveled not only around the state, but he traveled around the country talking about what he thought the value of playing athletics, and particularly football, were. And you have one whole chapter that you call Zupkeisms. He was quite an entertaining speaker, and he had a lot of aphorisms and witty sayings. Give us just a few that give a picture of some of his values.
Well, his values were, in his references to witticisms and so forth, were usually given at alumni meetings, alumni clubs, or at the annual Rotary football banquets, or he would occasionally speak to a professional group and give his views. But they related to offense, defense. One-liners. I thought for a while that he was drawing it from Nietzsche, but the more as you look at the total work in this area, Proverbs seems to be more relevant. They were very short, colorful maxims for players in the media. And the media would frequently publish a new list of Zupkeisms, little one-line statements that he had. One of them was, when you're blocking, you should hit them to make their ribs squeak, which was a little bit much, but it was got through to the students.
To the players, sure.
Yes, what they should do. He said that it was a civilizing force, and he had rules for coaching, for playing, mental exercises. He also brought in a psychologist, Coleman Griffith, who was later provost at the university. But in his first years at Illinois, Griffith was a psychologist who would go to the football practice, take notes on all of the players, and then discuss them with Zupke. Zupke had taken psychology courses at the University of Wisconsin.
He himself was a college graduate.
Did quite well at the University of Wisconsin. He went to Milwaukee Normal for 2 years, then to Wisconsin for 2 years, got his Ph.B. But he used the sports psychology, and he and Griffith collaborated on manuscripts and books relating to sports psychology.
When he would talk around at these banquets, often the press reports, as you report on them, the newspaper people were just entranced by his style, his rapid-fire style, his jumping from one topic to another, his witticisms. You report that in one of his speeches, he was interrupted 50 times with laughter and applause.
Group of engineers, I believe.
Uh-huh.
Well, it He was very popular and in demand, and at one point George Huff said that if you form an alumni club in this little town, first you form the club and then with Sen Zupke.
Uh-huh. Now, sportsmanship was very important to him, and Illinois at one point had a whole list of Ten Commandments on sportsmanship.
Those were Huff's list, yes.
Yeah, George Huff, as athletic director, came up with it, but presumably in conference with Zupke.
Yes, they walked to work together.
Uh-huh. And as I read through that list, many of them were things that are still taught today, like treat your opponent with respect, don't boo the referee. But there were a couple that today just wouldn't fly at all. Do you want to say anything about those?
The Orange Crush, I think, might be a problem with
yeah. You weren't supposed to harass the other player when they were shooting free throws, for example.
Yeah, things like that have been changed.
Right. But in general, playing clean was something that Zupke emphasized.
Mm-hmm. And not complaining. One of his statements was that the sportsmanship is when nature squawks when it loses and crows when it wins. And he was counseling that you should avoid going to extremes, whether you win or whether you lose.
And although his life was committed to football, and he obviously cared greatly about winning, nevertheless, he said that it's a game, and the important thing is what happens after football in your life.
Right. It's merely a start, yes. Uh-huh. And I think many of his players in later years came back. They were the chief supporters of Zupke when the athletic establishment started wanting to get him out of the coaching position. Players came back and defended him.
He was having a series of losses in the 30s, and we can talk about some of the reasons for that that might be relevant to the current season for Illinois football. But let me take just a minute. We're about halfway through our program. Our guest again is Maynard Bridgeford, the author of Bob Zupke, The Life and Football Legacy of the Illinois Coach. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week will be Professor Harry Triandis from the Psychology Department, talking about his most recent book, Fooling Ourselves in Politics, Religion, and Terrorism. Professor Triandis is quite critical of religions, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And yet he sees some value in them, at least some of the time. So that should be a very interesting, provocative program. That's next week, November 29th, here on WILL AM 580. Service of Illinois Public Media. We can be heard at 580 AM, 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3, Urbana, and of course online at will.illinois.edu, where our programs are also archived after about a week or so after broadcast. On December 6th, our guest will be Dan Guillory from Millikan University in Decatur. He has a new book out on the Lincoln poems he's written about the life and activities of Abraham Lincoln on this 200th anniversary of Lincoln's birth. Guillory talks about many incidents in Lincoln's personal life and legal life and presidential life, some of which happened here in central Illinois, of course. In December, we have programs on ways to help your friends and neighbors when they're suffering some pain and difficulty in their lives. Amy Kandrak will be our guest on December 13. We'll have reports from several people who just came back from a trip to Palestine on December 20th. Those are some of the programs ahead on Keeping the Faith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for this program. Although I want to thank again Don Nolan for helping out several times when I've been traveling recently and doing so well with interviewing folks. He's a professor at Parkland College in philosophy and religion. Well, let's get back to our talk with Maynard Bridgeford. Maynard was the president in 1979 of the Society of American Archivists. His own papers at the university include a total of 17.2 cubic feet of published papers and records. He's written such things as archives and manuscripts, appraisals, and accessioning, I think the word is pronounced, which would you'd assume for a university archivist here for 33 years. But he's also written articles like one in 1980 called Seven Sinful Thoughts. I'm curious about that one, Maynard. What was that about?
Well, that was a beginning of a term as president of the SAA. Well, one of them that is constantly quoted back to me, the longest lasting quote was, we should let papers rot. All the preservationists were quite concerned about preserving every document for future use. But I think that if you assess the value of the document, good many things that are created should probably rot. They do not carry anything of value to the future.
So it really requires judgment, and since all judgments
evaluation
are
since
aren't judgments relative, how can you make decisions?
I also made some statements about automation too, and I think of those every time I have a glitch in the computer. But it's easy to get overly concerned about one particular facet of your employment.
Well, let me go back to that decision-making process. Were you advocating that the individual archivist should decide what should rot and what should be saved?
Well, archivists frequently are in the position of making that decision because the people who created the records may no longer be around, and what it involves is, as with the Germans, Fingerspitzengefühl, which is you hold up your finger, decide which way the wind is blowing. And there are academic winds. At certain times, the winds are all blowing in one direction. Then they change, and they blow from another direction. And you have to sort of be aware of what the demands are for the materials that you're retaining.
Now, your academic title was Professor of Library Administration, but you spent all of your time as university archivist here at the university from 1963 to 1995. And since your retirement, you've still gone regularly, of course, to the university library and its archives and helped out, I know. And here you are writing a book at this point based on partly or mainly the archives of the football coach. Are current football coaches donating their archives to the university like Zupke did?
The only coach I know of that we have is Ray Elliott. But Ray Elliott was Zupke's student in 1930, and when he took over from Zupke in 1942, it was just a different kind of Zupke. But Ray was a German. His initial name was Ray Nussbaum, and he was an inspiring speaker, just like Zupke.
Now, you give in your last chapter some of the legacies of Zupke, and I want to focus on a few of them. Let's start with Memorial Stadium. Memorial Stadium came about during the Zupke years. He was probably the primary fundraiser for it. Tell us about that.
One of the fictions has been that the football did not pay. This is not the case, particularly soon when the stadium was built. Illinois had the second big stadium in the Big Ten. Ohio was first. But these huge stadia brought in large quantities of money to the university. The money that came from the football games eventually paid for the Memorial Stadium, for Huff Hall, for the ice rink. These were bailed out by the football profits.
And the non-revenue sports that so many students participated
in. Non-revenue sports. Intramurals started in World War I, and that also drew some support. So he and Huff went coast to coast, speaking to alumni, legislators, about their need to subscribe to the stadium fund. And this was the first huge non-state funded facility.
And tell a little bit about the fact that it cost $2 million, which in 1924, was it, was an amazing amount. I guess there were pledges in 1922, and then finally total in what had already been received was $2 million.
Zupke gave the fiery speech to the students in 1921, and the students pledged. Now, they were advised to check with their parents, but many of the students got carried away, and they had, but this was true in the 20s, you had to come back and try and get the pledges paid, and they would frequently mention this at any speech.
It's interesting that they started this drive with the students as opposed to alums. Mm-hmm. And there weren't that many students during those years, but I noticed that you have in your book the record that there were, 2,500 students who were on committees, 7,000 attended a mass meeting in April of 21. There were 600 county student solicitors that went to the various counties throughout the state, a tremendous
much of this organization
relying on students.
It was very well organized. George Huff paid $100,000 for Sampson Raphaelson, which was a good investment. Sampson Raphaelson was a advertising man. He graduated from the university in about 1916, but he later wound up in Hollywood as a screenwriter for motion pictures. And Raphaelson organized this campaign, and they divided all the students were sort of drafted into the activity. It was money well spent, I think, to get the this kind of organizer.
But it was controversial at the time to use athletic funds to hire a professional fundraiser like that to sort of oversee the whole.
Didn't bother the Athletic Association, which was not directly reporting to anybody other than the president of the university.
Uh-huh.
The presidents, there's a chapter on the presidents. James and Kinley were behind intercollegiate athletics.
They supported it, yeah.
Largely because they had the option of passing out several thousand free tickets to legislators, friends of the university, and so forth.
So it really built support for the university, they believed.
Right.
Yeah,
and the stadium was essentially a stage for the performing art of football.
Uh-huh.
And Zupke was an artist, but his football teams were also. It's more like a play where he was a director and he would cast the football talent into a team that would win a Big Ten championship, and he won seven of those.
Seven Big Ten and two national championships.
And some of them were shared with other universities,
yes.
But this was in the period up to 1929. After that, it changed.
Right. Then it was hard to get students. And Zupke didn't believe in personally being involved in recruiting at all. And I want to talk about that, but let's say that just for a moment. Let me focus a bit more on the stadium, because that drive was just so amazing. They had a song that they sang when they went out to alumni clubs eventually. And it took a long time for people to pay those pledges, and some were never paid. But eventually the stadium started producing enough income to pay for itself, which was no one knew. They couldn't count on that in those days. This was the first one in the state.
You have to gamble.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, let's talk a little bit about the recruiting issue, because that's so different from today. Today, coaches see as their probably one number one job, getting players to come to the university who are able to get in and stay in and play football at a very high level, but Zupke just didn't do that.
He had sort of an old-fashioned attitude that people ought to come to the university to get an education, and they also ought to be appreciative of the opportunity to play for their state institution, the state university. And he did not believe that you had to offer them money. You might try and find a job for them, and, but he had other people do that, an individual in the athletic department would try and find jobs for players. Zupke would not do that, and Zupke was more of a talent specialist. He would go to track meets, and that's where he saw this fellow from Wheaton win a bunch of dashes every year. So he went over and told Grange that if you come to your state university, you might make the football team, and he did.
So Red Grange, the Wheaton Iceman, was seen on a track meet, not on a football field. And was not offered a scholarship.
He had to learn how to play football when he got here from Zupke.
And he couldn't play as a freshman.
No.
But Zupke would have open tryouts. Anyone who's passed their freshman year
and the numbers were high, too.
Huge
they would, anywhere from 300 to 500 kids would turn
show
out
up, yeah.
for freshmen. And then they would gradually find out what was involved, and the number declined. But the coaching staff, there's always a freshman football coach, would recommend that certain players be given jobs and encouraged to go on and play for the last
for
3 years.
For the varsity. Let's talk, before we talk about recruiting, one other thing about the actual playing the game, because you described what Zupke did as a sort of a play director, creating this spectacle that people were excited to see. And it wasn't all just winning. Yes, that was important, but he really put on a show. Tell us about some of his plays. He was just so creative in coming up with football plays, things that today would just seem amazing, like three laterals and then a pass diagonally across the field. And
well, this started with his high school teams at Muskegon and Michigan and Oak Park. He took his Oak Park team to Seattle, Washington, Poland, or Portland, Oregon, Boston, Massachusetts, to play intersectional games, and particularly the game in Massachusetts against Everett High School. They were said the game was, he's playing more like basketball, where they were throwing the ball back and forth. Zupke studied the rules, and he knew what you could do. The forward pass, this was before Newt Rockne and Gus Doré, there were thousands of people throwing forward passes and laterals, and Zupke devised plays. He was a drill master. A Prussian drill master, perhaps, but he had them practice signals and so forth, and his teams were coached. He did not believe in getting, it wasn't a matter of getting huge players or great stars. They had to play as a team.
And play fast. He wanted fast players.
Yeah, open style.
Yeah. You talk about him beating Michigan and Ohio State with small, fast men, and he was himself quite small.
Yeah, yeah, he's quite very short. He beat Michigan 9 times, I think, under different circumstances, but upsets. We also specialize in upsets of teams that are favored.
And he would analyze their play and come up with good counters. Well, let's talk about this recruiting issue. What did he feel was wrong with it?
Recruiting, proselytizing was called. And, of course, they said, Zupke said, well, the churches do it, which may be a religious connection. But the recruitment was basically through fraternities, I think. The fraternities played a prominent role. And there was no housing for men other than fraternities or maybe occasional rooming houses.
There were no dormitories provided by the universities in those years.
And the fraternities would be interested in trying to get football players in there because it would raise the perhaps the
status
peer group opinion of their fraternity. They also published in those days the grade point averages of all the fraternities, which had another effect on the housing, through the housing. And housing, the other incentives were tickets occasionally for the players. We'd get certain tickets for games. Usually it was for the early games, not for the big ones, with the Big Ten games.
Zupke achieved his height of success at the end of the 20s in 1929, and then in the 30s, with the Depression, recruiting, there just weren't very many good players coming here compared to the ones who from the Chicago area were going to University of Chicago, which still had a major football team, and Northwestern or Notre Dame. Illinois just suffered because it was expensive to travel. People weren't coming as much to the university, and football players were being recruited by other coaches who were happy to recruit.
This changed in the 1930s was a period of change.
Yes.
The other schools got their stadiums, and they were providing a lot more competition.
We have a caller on line number one. Let's go to that line. Yes, in Urbana, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest Maynard Bridgeford. Go ahead.
I missed the first part of the program, but I wondered if you've talked about compensation for Coach Zupke.
We did talk a bit about compensation. He was hired for $2,500. After the first couple Big Ten championships, they kicked it up to $8,000. And by 1930, he was up to $10,000. I think we said early on that this would be equivalent of about the $1 million that is currently paid to coaches.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he was compensated. But I don't know what the significance.
How would his salary compare with the president's salary, for instance?
He never got as much as the president. In fact, George Huff said he was several thousand dollars below the president's. He was in a par with some of the deans.
Thank you for the call. As opposed to currently, do you know what the proportions are?
Well, there are a lot more coaches today, and their salaries are probably the assistants today do quite well. I don't know. I think that's probably the whole scale has gone up, but I think there are more people involved on the payroll than there were.
Zupke had a relatively small staff.
Yes, this is one of the keys of success. Zupke had a in his tenure as coach, a business manager, a trainer, a publicity man, a psychologist, and the whole series of assistants.
When you were talking earlier about Zupke's values, he was highly respected by his assistants and people who played for him. He was a tough taskmaster, as you said, and made the men concentrate and work hard. But there are a huge number of them after his death in 1957 and during his later years when the trustees and others were trying to get him fired because of his losing record in the 1930s. They came to his defense and really supported him.
Yes, there was an effort made to get his resignation in 1938, but that did not stick when the word got out in Chicago that they wanted his resignation. He stayed another couple of years. And in 1941, he was. They had a new board of trustees elected, and so Zupke anticipated their opposition and resigned. But he had served for 29 years as coach.
Now we're down to our last minute with Maynard Bridgeford, the author of Bob Zupke, The Life and Football Legacy of the Illinois Coach. We've been talking about ethics and sports, particularly football. We're down to our last minute, but before his death in 57, Zupke came up with a proposal to sort of clean up some of the things that he thought were abuses in football. And he had a radical proposal that only seniors should be allowed to play football.
Yeah. Well, when he was coach, sophomores, juniors, and seniors could play. But by cutting it down to seniors, this was somewhat unrealistic, but he was free to express an opinion at that time. And he objected to the overemphasis on football. At times, it seems odd in considering his career, but he did not believe that this was the main purpose of going to university.
Well, perhaps that's a good place to leave the discussion with Maynard Bridgeford, B-R-I-C-H-F-O-R-D, whose new book is called Bob Zupke, The Life and Football Legacy of the Illinois Coach. Maynard was a university archivist here at the University of Illinois from 1963 to 1995, 32 years, even longer than the 29 years that Zupke was coach of the football team. I want to thank Maynard for being here today and talking with us on Keeping the Faith. Next week, our guest will be Harry Triandis. We'll be talking about issues in his new book, Fooling Ourselves, in Politics, Religion, and Terrorism. On December 6th, our guest will be Dan Guillory from Millikan University, who's a poet, and some of the poems that he's written about Lincoln's life and events in his life. I'm Steve Shoemaker, usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Let me remind you that if you missed part of this program or would like to hear any previous programs, they're easily accessible online if you go to will.illinois.edu. Then you'll have choices between AM, FM, and TV. Click on AM, and then you can look for Keeping the Faith, and they're listed by date, or you can put in a name or a subject in the search engine, and we'll find that program, and you can listen to it at your convenience on your own computer. Thanks for listening live today to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.